Iku Iluna, please rise. Ea ka aha, kolo kolo ki eke hanahano, ua a koa koa ho maila. This Honorable Supreme Court is now reconvened. E no ho ilalo, please be seated.
Will you please call the case?
Case number SCWC-23-0000662. Deutsche Bank National Trust Company Americas, Respondent Plaintiff Appellee versus Yun Ru, Petitioner Defendant Appellant, and Kaohe Ranch Subdivision Homeowners Association et al., Defendants Appellees. Arguing for Petitioner Yun Ru, Frederick Arnsmeyer. Arguing for Respondent, Deutsche Bank National Trust Company Americas, Zachary Kondo. Also appearing is Mary Martin. Argument on the merits.
Good afternoon. These proceedings are being shown live on our Judiciary YouTube channel and also on Olelo. Also like to welcome our Substitute Justice from the First Circuit, Judge Kevin Souza. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Counsel, ready to proceed?
Okay.
Each side has 30 minutes. I understand, Mr. Arnsmeyer, you want to reserve 15 minutes for rebuttal?
That's right.
We'll do that. And also, you'll have a warning at the five-minute mark. Is that what you wanted?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. We hear from you.
Good afternoon. I'm happy to be here today to present this important procedural issue for the court's consideration. In this case, petitioner maintains that the ICA committed two underlying grave errors of law. The first error being that, according to the ICA, default judgments are now categorically excluded from consideration under Rule 60B6. Instead, the ICA has required that in all circumstances, whether it's ordinary circumstances or extraordinary circumstances, the correct test is the three-prong test discussed in Chen versus Ma. Even if we apply that test in this case, however, petitioner maintains that the ICA committed grave error in finding that the default that was entered in this case was the result of her own inexcusable neglect or a willful act. The record simply does not reflect that. First of all, on the 60B issue, no appellate court in this state, no case in the history of this state has ever held that relief is not available from a default judgment under Rule 60B6. That's a new rule that the ICA has essentially created through its decision. I believe that was unintentional, and I believe it was wrong. Other courts, including federal courts, as we pointed out, the Taney decision of the Ninth Circuit, routinely employ Rule 60B6 in evaluating whether or not to set aside default judgments upon a showing of exceptional circumstances. Meanwhile, I submit to this court, these two tests are not exclusive of one another. Both can be employed. Both can be read together consistently. The three-prong test, again, it applies in situations where ordinary circumstances are presented. A client who missed a deadline, there's no issue of, you know, attorney misconduct or abandonment.
Haven't there actually been cases that this court has not even applied the three-prong test, like Frankel? Recently?
There have, Your Honor. I will caution the court, though. Franco, in a strict sense, did not involve a default judgment, although this court did essentially treat it as much insofar as the client in that case was abandoned and not represented at trial.
Well, and 55C says that if a judgment, default judgment has entered, then it's to be addressed under 60B, and it doesn't say under 60B except for 60B6, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And in fact, the Stafford case cited in our application is another example of applying, in that case, it was Rule 60B4, but the court in that case specifically said you don't have to show the three prongs. You don't have to make any showing of a meritorious defense if you're moving under Rule 60B4. Same rationale should apply here under Rule 60B6. Again, I think the distinction between the two, the three-prong test applies to ordinary circumstances. The 60B6 test applies to extraordinary circumstances.
Mr. Arnsmeyer, then in the ICA, I'm trying to understand, I think you argued both, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so I'm trying to understand your position on how these tests either should apply alternatively or is somehow intertwined. What is your position clearly on that?
I think either test can apply, and if either of them works to provide relief, either test can be employed. I believe that the showing of extraordinary circumstances is a heightened burden, and it's based on equitable considerations. It's a different scenario than the routine ordinary circumstances that are addressed under the three prongs, which is more of a strict legal test, less equitable.
You know, going back and looking at BDM, it was a per curiam opinion, and it was the BDM three-part test was set out sort of as guidance going forward for folks. It wasn't even really used in that case to decide that case. I'm just curious if you have a position on whether BDM, the three-part test, is still useful or if parts of it are useful.
Oh, I think it's absolutely useful. There's no reason for this court to strike that test or do anything. Like, it should continue. That, again, that's the standard that should be applied in every case upon ordinary circumstances.
How do you define ordinary circumstances?
Well, for example, a missed answer. A missed answer and none of these other facts where a defendant immediately hires counsel, the plaintiff agrees that the default will be set aside. It's the intention of all parties that the litigation is going to be decided on the merits. And then counsel disappears. That's extraordinary. That's different. It would have been a totally different question, you know, had plaintiff in this case refused to set aside default, and then my client's attorney at the time filed a motion to set aside that default. That would have been ordinary circumstances.
Well, that would have been good cause under Chen versus Ma, right?
Well, and yes, I would submit that it would have been.
The test, is
correct.
Good cause, because
correct.
You're not dealing then with a default judgment. You would have been dealing with an entry of default.
Right. So
I'm sorry, why don't you think that Justin Seddon's opinion in that JKDK case that came out in 2023 kind of reconciled everything? Do you read it that way or you read it differently? I'm not quite sure what the conflict is here.
I'm sorry, which
the case? JK versus DK case, 2023, August?
Yes.
They seem to wrap everything up.
I don't see a conflict. I see things as being consistent, and that's what was missed in this case. We presented extraordinary circumstances, but we also presented, you know, the alternative argument, the three-prong test. And again, you know, either one of those could have been used to set aside this default.
Well, this opinion says all relevant circumstances. Wouldn't that encompass all of that?
Again, all relevant circumstances, the facts, yes, of course. I would agree.
Right, so then why BDM? I mean, Jessica Noz is saying, you know, why would you even have BDM? Didn't JK clear that up and pretty much just say, this is an equitable rule? We're going to look at all the circumstances. We're going to see if there's good cause. I mean, you're advocating for BDM, but that third factor, inexcusable neglect, you know, that sort of works against you. Now, JK recalibrated prejudice, recalibrated meritorious defense to make it less harsh, and also has the language about all relevant circumstances. So I guess based on some of the questions I've heard from both of my colleagues, it's why do we need BDM? Why are we talking about BDM? Do you think we should be?
I don't think so. I think this case is narrower. The question here is Rule 60B6 relief categorically excluded for consideration under Rule 60B6, extraordinary circumstances? The court need not affect either any of its prior.
Well, I mean, Frankel discussed 60B6 in extraordinary circumstances, right?
Yes, it did.
So why would it be excluded? I don't understand why it would be excluded when this court has discussed extraordinary circumstances in the context of 60B6.
I'm sorry, is the question why would 60B6? Well, Franco didn't involve, again, a default judgment in the strict procedural sense.
60B is to set aside a judgment. It doesn't really matter whether it's a default judgment or it's a summary judgment or a judgment after a trial. Does it?
That's why I'm here today. I agree with you, Your Honor. The rule applies.
If it's a default judgment, though, then we might think of some things, you know, like the merits were never reached. So, but you know, maybe we do consider whether or not there was a meritorious defense. But it, you know, I mean, I'm sorry, J.K. did lower the standard of what that meritorious defense would have to be. It's not like you're going to prevail. J.K. describes it as a valiant defense.
I would submit that it's really a question of the circumstances. Every case is going to be different, and the factors that the court's going to consider and give weight to are going to be different based on a case-by-case basis. You know, the timing of a Rule 60B motion is important as well, and it's going to factor. It's going to basically touch on a lot of those same issues.
By the way, speaking of timing, since you are speaking of timing, and it really wasn't addressed by the parties, why is it reasonable 14 months later in your particular situation?
Well, that's a good question, and I acknowledge those facts cut against us. At the same time, Mike. Client was abandoned. She did not know that her mortgage had been foreclosed, that this thing had gone to sale, and that in fact the bank had owned the property until all of a sudden her tenant received a notice to vacate. Once that happened, within I believe less than a month, counsel was hired and a Rule 60B motion was filed.
Well, you know, it seems odd that you're saying your client really didn't know when there was the loan modification, there was communications with the husband. I mean, it almost seems like it really wasn't a lawyer problem, it was a client problem based under these facts. It seems like it was her free and deliberate choice to sort of drop the ball on herself and wait for that door to knock from the commissioner.
You know, I'm not sure that the record reflects that. In fact, what this record does reflect is the client applied outside of the litigation, outside of her attorney, for a loan modification. That was not handled through counsel, other than the one act of him forwarding the application.
Once she had that modification, she failed to make that first payment, right?
I don't know if she was ever informed that she qualified or that she needed to make that first payment. Those facts don't appear in this record.
Go ahead. You can finish.
Your point is well taken. Again, those are all the facts, the circumstances that should be considered, you know, in determining are these circumstances extraordinary. And if there's evidence that cuts against it, it should be presented. But I don't believe those facts appear at least cleanly on this record, other than through basically argument.
So there was a genuine issue of material fact on those facts.
Well, I mean, there is a question. Did the client receive an actual modification offer? And if so, did she willingly ignore it? I don't know. But again, that's outside of the litigation. She wasn't doing that through her attorney. The big problem here is she wasn't getting notice of what was happening in the litigation.
Well, counsel, let me point you to exhibits 3 and 4, which were submitted with the plaintiff's memorandum in opposition to your client's motion to set aside default judgments. And they appear to be correspondence regarding the mortgage assistance program. So are you contesting whether she in fact was approved for a loan modification?
No, I'm saying this record doesn't identify whether or not she actually received notice that she qualified. We don't dispute that she participated and that an offer was made. The question is, was it ever communicated to her? Did she receive it by mail? Did she know that she needed to make a first payment and that if she didn't, that something was going to happen in the litigation? Those facts simply don't appear on this record.
So if you have conflicting evidence, as you've proposed, is the solution then to allow for an evidentiary hearing to address whether there are extraordinary circumstances under 60B6?
Well, I think it would be appropriate, and in fact, in this case, in their opposition, plaintiffs asked if an evidentiary hearing could be held and the prior counsel could be brought in and questioned. We filed a reply. We had no objection to that. That seemed like a reasonable and a perfectly good idea, assuming he could be located and agreed to appear and testify.
Because there's some indication in the record that Mr. Sanaha, the prior counsel, also had communications with the commissioner once we were in that phase of the litigation. But I didn't see anything directly from him necessarily. No declaration from him with regards to what his communications actually were with your client.
That's right. There are statements by the commissioner in a declaration, hearsay statements about what Mr. Sanaha allegedly told him, but those facts were never verified. And that's a very, very good reason to perhaps hold that kind of an evidentiary hearing. I'm not saying it has to be done. I think there's enough on this record that the motion should have been granted and things set aside and the litigation, you know, proceed on the merits. But at the same time, I do think an evidentiary hearing can be appropriate. And I see that my timing light is on. I'll reserve the rest for rebuttal unless there's...
Did your client submit an affidavit or something saying that she did not participate and she had no idea that the loan modification, she had been approved for loan modification?
She did not.
But you're asking us to presume that because even though there's exhibits indicating that loan modification approval was mailed to her, she didn't receive it.
Well, I'm saying we don't know. Those facts don't appear on this record. What is
well,
known,
then why shouldn't we apply the presumption under 303A 10 that a letter properly addressed and mailed is presumed to have been received in the ordinary course of the mail? Why shouldn't we just presume that she received it?
Well, I think given the broader context here of someone who's obviously having communication problems with her lawyer, I don't know if the thing was mailed to her address, if she actually
received it. I'm sorry, it's a Malibu address. That wasn't her address?
Or if she was out of the country.
Okay.
None of those facts appear. Those would all be fair game for an evidentiary hearing.
It would have been much easier if she submitted an affidavit or a declaration saying, I didn't receive the loan modification letter, and there is no such letter.
It would have,
affidavit.
That would have had to have come up in a reply brief. It's not really something that we would have included in this motion. Those are facts that are being argued to say, hey, well, maybe she's not credible because she was, you know, applying for a loan mod, and here's some things that happened outside of this litigation.
All right.
I want to save the rest of your time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Zachary Kondo, and I represent the respondent, plaintiff, appellee, Deutsche Bank National Trust Company. I believe the ICA correctly affirmed the circuit court's denial of Ms. Rue's motion to set aside, and that this court should affirm as well. I want to begin with one foundational fact, is that the clerk's entry of default against Ms. Rue was entered on February 26, 2021. She had been served in January 2021. So she didn't retain an attorney until March 9th, 2021, 13 days after the default had been entered. So everything that Ms. Rue attributes to Mr. Sanaha's negligence had already happened. Her default had already been entered.
Well, I mean, she hadn't had a lawyer then. It's during COVID. Are you really going to put all your eggs in that line?
No.
Do you think the ICA erred with their key holding here that, as your colleague on the other side says, has never, ever happened before? It's not in our case law. Did the ICA err with their 60B6 language?
I don't believe so, because the procedural reality of the case is that there was a default, and their motion for summary judgment, default judgment, entered against Ms. Rue. So procedurally, I believe that what the ICA found was legally accurate.
I'm not talking about, how about this ruling? What the ICA said was that it ruled that the good cause standard controls HRCP Rule 55 motions. But leaves untouched the BDMS factors for HRCP Rule 60B motions. Okay, actually, that's not what they said. I'm trying to find that language. Mr. Arnsmar certainly knows what it is. But you know the language we're talking about? What the key language about them accepting cert on is? You agree that the ICA was correct in that statement?
In the application of the facts in this case, yes. I believe
that the exceptional circumstances doesn't apply, and that's categorical.
In this situation, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, but it didn't seem like they were tethering it to this specific situation, but they were making a categorical statement that 60B6 doesn't apply.
Well, we believe that the three factors, the BDM factors, was correctly implemented, or at least the inexcusable neglect factor, because it's conjunctive, was correctly applied in this case.
Okay, but okay, let me back up then. I mean, getting back to exactly what was said is basically the ICA was saying that 60B6 is unavailable as an alternative path to set aside a default judgment. That was the key language there. Do you agree with that language?
Yes. And, well, yes, for a motion to set aside a default judgment, yes.
Those, no looking at 60Bs at all?
No looking at the exceptional circumstances, the extraordinary circumstances of 60B6. I don't believe so. I mean, I could see a situation where both could be analyzed, or perhaps as part of the excusable neglect analysis, but I think in this situation, the ICA was correct.
Okay, sorry to continue.
Okay. So my argument basically proceeds in two layers. One, the ICA was correct in applying the three factors. And two, even if solely the exceptional circumstances rule applies, appellee still prevails. with respect to the three factors, the ICA's characterization of this as a default judgment is correct and grounded in the procedural reality. Again, default was entered back in February 26, 2021, before she retained an attorney. The combined motion for default and summary judgment was filed in this context. The summary judgment standard the court applied reflects how it evaluated Deutsche Bank's evidence, not a finding that Ms. Rue had meaningfully participated in this litigation. As to Ms. Rue, the judgment was entered against a defaulted defendant. So the ICA's holding that Chen v. Ma governs is also grounded in a case cited by appellant Salvacion.
How do you distinguish Franco versus Reinhardt? It's a 2023 written opinion of this court that applied 60B6 to a default judgment.
But we have case law on the other side, like Salvacion.
That's a written, is that a published opinion of this court?
No.
Aren't published opinions of this court binding?
Yes.
So I thought you were going to be coming here to argue, despite the ICA's error, the error was harmless.
Yes.
I thought that's what the argument was going to be. Do you have any arguments along those lines?
Yes.
What are they?
So even if the three factors were not applicable and we only concentrated on exceptional circumstances, we believe appellee still prevails because the record doesn't reflect exceptional circumstances, a total abandonment by Mr. Sanaha of Ms. Rue. I don't believe the record supports that finding. The facts are not, I mean, the facts are disputed. As this court has referenced, there was a motion to satisfy. We filed a memorandum in opposition, which included the loss mitigation, loan modification, trial period plan, as well as a denial letter. And we had offered that we hold an evidentiary hearing to question Mr. Sanaha on the verify the accuracy of the statements made by Ms. Rue in her motion. Counsel is correct in that they didn't object to that request, but by their own words, they said it was unnecessary. So they decided to stand on.
And there was no reply at declaration saying that no, the Ms. Rue had never received the loan modification letter.
That's correct. There was no reply, so they had an opportunity to say, and this is the first time I'm hearing of this argument that Ms. Rue may or may not have received the offer. But again, yeah, the reply did not include a declaration from Ms. Rue attesting to having never received this application. I mean, this offer, sorry.
I'm sorry, I can't remember the facts exactly. Did your client purchase the property at the foreclosure sale?
Yes. So,
it has not been transferred?
No, it's okay. Still in their name. They're unable to sell it because pretty much no buyer will purchase a property that's in ongoing appeal. Mm-hmm. I think one thing that is important to remember under the exceptional circumstances standard is that the law requires exceptional circumstances that prevented or rendered the moving party incapable of rendering an appeal. So the record needs to show that she was never able to prosecute an appeal. And I don't believe that the record supports the finding. And
well, in that regard, though, Mr. Kondo, her declaration states that she, the first time she ever heard about any default judgment or judgments against her and the confirmation judgment wasn't until July of 2023. That's like a year or so after the default judgment and summary judgment was entered in April of 2022. So if the record establishes that she was not aware of anything that was happening in the case, I mean, I don't know what was happening in terms of the communication with Mr. Sanaha That's kind of a blank here in this case. But if that's what the record is, how could she have appealed from the default judgment and summary judgment?
That's a good point. And I think that in the cases that were cited where there's allegations of gross negligence by a client's attorney, in all the cases that are successful, the client has to be found diligent and not negligent and blameless. So a lot of these clients were either actively deceived by their attorney. The attorney tells them everything's fine, such as in Tawny. The attorney actively misrepresented the status of the case. But here we have a client for almost 2 years that doesn't check in on the status of her case. In fact, by her own declaration, it doesn't support a finding of a reasonable client, because her and her husband had a conversation with Mr. Sanaha over the telephone after they had emailed him asking for status. And he claims that he doesn't, or at least by her husband's hearsay account, that Mr. Sanaha doesn't know who they were. I think a reasonable client at that point would either find a new attorney or take a very more active role in monitoring the status of their case.
What was the date again of that phone call? Do you have that handy? That was in her declaration, right?
Yes. That was in June 2021. Okay. They had, it was, you know, it was hearsay because it was done through her husband, declared in her declaration. But they had a phone, the husband had checked the court docket. They found that nothing had been done except the filing of a notice of appearance. So they had emailed Mr. Sanaha requesting for status. I guess they didn't hear back, so they called him, and then he claimed he didn't know who they were. So then, I mean, that's kind of where their declaration ends, or her declaration ends, and there's nothing further done, except when we filed our memorandum in opposition, and we included a copy of an email that in line in the email is Ms. Rue forwarding the loan modification application to Mr. Sanaha, who then forwarded it to us. So, again, I don't believe the record is complete. It's sort of a curated record. And defendant had, again, going back to the reply memo, Ms. Rue had said that any further inquiry with Mr. Sanaha was unnecessary. So in our position, the record is what it is. They shouldn't be allowed to go back and get a second bite of the apple and supplement the record. I mean, my client has had to incur the carrying costs of the property for several years. So that's property taxes and insurance. Ms. Rue has received a Chapter 7 discharge. So the recourse for my client is only as to the property. So every month or every day, the interest increases. So that recovery is capped at the value of the property.
To put the chronology in perspective, your client filed the motion for default judgment and summary judgment, in April, it looks like August of 2021. And then there were a series of stays.
Yes.
And as I understand the record, if you can please clarify if this is incorrect, but what I understand are those stays were prompted because of the loan modification efforts?
Exactly. And that's a good point that you brought up. So the motion for summary judgment was granted orally in October 2021. Exactly 1 month later, Ms. Ruth submits a loss mitigation application, which prompted the two stays. In my opinion, I think that's suggestive that she knew what was happening. And then she
signed the loan modification request?
Yes. You have to submit the application along with, pay stubs, bank accounts, tax returns.
I don't see the loan loan application in the record.
It's
I see other correspondence.
It's not in the record.
Okay. So there's no loan application document with her signature on it anywhere?
Not in this record.
In the record. Okay.
So, yes, going back to the timeline. So, again, she submits the application in November. She gets approved for a trial mod, I believe it's February 2021. She's required to make the initial payment. She doesn't make the initial payment, and then a denial letter is issued to her. The offer advises her that if she doesn't accept it, the foreclosure case is going to move forward. So again, going back to what a diligent...
Where is that in the record?
That would be Exhibit 3.
Exhibit 3.
That's the offer. It's on page 2. It's on the, there's three sets of bullet points. It's the third set. It's the first bullet point. Any pending foreclosure action or proceeding that has been suspended may be resumed if failure to comply with the terms of the plan.
Does the record reflect whether or not any of these payments were made?
Well, the denial letter was issued, so the presumption is no, these payments were not made.
Wait a minute. The record does not reflect, because I see at least three payments that are laid out in the modification letter. I'm just wondering, does the record reflect whether any of the payments were made? Which would indicate, if a payment was made, it would indicate that she did have notice of the loan modification. So I'm asking, does the record reflect whether any of these payments were made? Just the record.
No.
Thank you.
I would just state that Exhibit 5 is the denial letter. Exhibit 4 is the denial letter. And the basis of the denial is that you failed to make the initial trial payments within the required time frame. And nowhere in the record has she contested that she had made the payments. I mean, if she had... presumably, the modification would have been made permanent. So I'm going back to the fact that every successful exceptional circumstances case is premised on a diligent, non-negligent client, because the legal standard requires that the extraordinary circumstances render the party unable to prosecute a timely appeal. So that leaves only a collateral attack to the judgment available. We don't believe appellant is that client. And there are only two explanations for the pattern of inaction in this record, and neither renders her blameless. The first explanation is that Mr. Sanaha was executing his client's strategy to focus on loss mitigation, either directly or through her husband. And so he actively chose not to contest the motion for summary judgment or motion to sell without open houses or the confirmation. I mean, the commissioner's declaration states that he spoke with Mr. Sanaha, who I understand is hearsay, but that Mr. Sanaha spoke with Ms. Rue and said that she wasn't going to allow open houses. So, I mean, under this explanation, there's no gross negligence. Mr. Sanaha was simply executing his client's strategy.
Well, you know, I think there's room to debate what the record actually shows in light of the declarations that we actually have, yes, and the hearsay statements and, you know, so forth and so on. So, you know, my question to Mr. Arnsmeyer earlier was, you know, the potential for an evidentiary hearing to really figure out whether there is extraordinary circumstances here. And what I understand from both counsel is you folks both were agreeable to that, and the circuit court just didn't have one. Is that the circumstance?
That is the circumstance. We suggested it to verify Ms. Ruth's statements and what Mr. Sanaa did or did not say, because it is a he said, she said situation. But in their reply, they said they didn't object to it, but they said it was unnecessary. So now our client, they had the opportunity years ago, but now they're going to have a second bite at the apple. I think that's prejudicial to my client and their ability to move on from this case. So in my opinion, the second explanation for what happened according to the record is that, I mean, even assuming the facts in the light most favorable to Ms. Rue, I still don't believe she's a blameless client. She didn't, like I said, she didn't make the trial modification payments despite being approved and explicitly warned that failure to pay would result in the foreclosure moving forward. By her own record, she did not follow up with Mr. Sanaha after her husband's June 2021 email and telephone call. There's no other record of documented attempts to communicate with Mr. Sanaha after the modification was denied in February 2022. She did not monitor her case despite her and her husband showing a knowledge of how to monitor cases and look up the status of a case on Acorn Kukua. And she did not inquire about the status of the case for almost a year and a half between the modification denial letter in February 22, and when the notice to vacate was served back in July 2023. I think a reasonable person that had applied for a loan mod and didn't accept it would understand that the foreclosure is going to move forward, and it's probably just a matter of time before that's completed.
Does the record reflect the date of the last payment toward this mortgage?
Yes, there in the motion for summary judgment, I believe the default date was December 2014.
That was the date of the last payment?
That's not the date of the last payment. That's the date that the last contractual payment was satisfied. So it's different than, like, if you have a rolling default,
There may be additional payments, but it's not pursuant to the...
Yes.
So the record does not reflect the date of the last payment.
Doesn't it reflect the date that she made her last payment?
Does the record reflect whether or not who is in possession of the property?
In physical possession?
Yes.
I believe based on the account from the motion to set aside, it was a tenant that was occupying the property.
A tenant?
Tenant.
Of?
Ms. Rue.
Continues to occupy the property.
No, it's vacant. I believe it's vacant now.
Vacant. Okay.
Okay, I believe my time is coming to an end. Let's make some concluding remarks. Your Honors, the Circuit Court and the ICA both reached the correct result, and this court should affirm. I believe this court has two grounds on which to affirm this decision. If they apply the Chen v. Ma factors, I believe that those factors all weigh in favor of my client.
Can we call them the BDM versus Sage cofactors,
yes.
Not the Chen versus Ma yes. factors?
The BDM v Sage cofactors. Those factors are conjunctive, but all those factors weigh in favor of my client. The default in this case was Ms. Ru's own conduct, entered 13 days before she retained an attorney. During that 28-day period, she didn't reach out to opposing counsel in my office to request additional time to file an answer. Mr. Sanaha's subsequent conduct, whatever its deficiencies, cannot retroactively excuse that default. And the record does not support the total abandonment narrative that exceptional circumstances replies. Ms. Ru personally prepared and submitted the modification application exactly 1 month after the MSJ was granted. I believe that's inconsistent with any claim that she had no knowledge of the proceedings. She and her husband demonstrated the ability to monitor the court docket. She received written notice of the modification offer and denial letter, and that the foreclosure would proceed if that modification offer was not accepted. When her husband allegedly called Mr. Sanaha and told her he did not know who they were, she did not seek new counsel, and she did not contact opposing counsel and did not monitor the case. And this is not the conduct of a client rendered incapable of protecting herself by her attorney's alleged misconduct. In short, the record does not support a finding of exceptional circumstances that rendered Ms. Ru incapable of prosecuting a timely appeal. So Deutsche Bank respectfully requests this court affirm the ICA's summary disposition order. And that concludes my prepared statements, unless the court has any further questions.
Nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, opposing counsel does accurately state the rule under Rule 60B6, extraordinary circumstances that would prevent a party from prosecuting an appeal. The time limit to file an appeal is 30 days after entry of judgment. The record here reflects that this client didn't receive notice of any of this until months and months and months later. Moreover, even if she had hypothetically received notice that a judgment had been entered, at that point an appeal would have been futile. She wouldn't have had a record to appeal. This record shows that her own attorney repeatedly failed to show up for hearings, didn't file anything.
Well, your argument is lack of standing to pursue. Isn't that, you know, going to what the other side presented on their initial burden? So I'm not sure that they would have nothing to challenge. Oftentimes, the appellate courts are looking at whether the bank has met their initial burden, right?
I understand your point. Well taken. Perhaps a standing argument could be raised, but more times than not, what appellate courts are going to hold is that arguments that you didn't make are waived. Sometimes a court will review for plain error. That's a long shot. So I take my statement back. There is an exception. There is plain error review, which may have been available. But go ahead.
What I want to ask you about is actually Mr. Kondo's argument that your client should have taken action when there was a call to Mr. Sanaha, and he purportedly told them or told the husband that, I don't know who you folks are. Factually, as well as what is the legal implication of that for purposes of this case?
Well, I don't think the record has the full context of that phone call and everything that was said. I don't believe that after that phone call, the client and her husband were of the impression that Mr. Sineha was not going to represent them. Despite that, I don't know who you are. That's not a good thing to say as an attorney who's taken a retainer a couple of months earlier. But at the same time, we don't have the transcript of that phone call or the testimony of the client's husband.
That's your own client's declaration, though, right? Where it says that.
But it is my client's declaration.
So to your mind, that's irrelevant to whether there are extraordinary circumstances under 60B6?
It's not irrelevant, but it's not a fact that just can be considered in isolation. If a court wants to, hang things on that point, then there needs to be perhaps an evidentiary hearing. What exactly happened during that phone call? What did Mr. Sineha say?
Because that time period in June of 2021 is even before Deutsche Bank filed its motion for default judgment and summary judgment.
It is. And it was after the bank had agreed that it would stipulate to set aside the default, which for whatever reason, it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm. You're indicating that it's extraordinary or the three part, right? But assuming the BDM versus Sageco factors are part of the equitable consideration and whether or not to set aside a judgment based on Rule 60B, what is your client's potential meritorious defense?
Well, it's actually addressed in the opening brief. The question of standing and the fact that the plaintiff did not meet their prima facie burden of establishing standing. There's a declaration.
And if we determine that the record does indicate they had the note at the time they filed the foreclosure complaint, that there's sufficient evidence of that, your valiant defense is gone?
Well, it's not a question of adjudicating the defense at this point. It's a question of, is it a legitimate defense?
If we say that meritorious defense is still an issue, and it doesn't have to be that you can definitely prove it, but there's got to be something there. Your argument is that your defense as to a meritorious defense is standing based on Bank of America versus Reyes Toledo and Deutsche Bank not having the note at the time it filed the foreclosure complaint. That is your only defense?
Well, more narrowly, that's the meritorious defense that we've identified. And in particular, it's a question of whether they were the holder of the note at the time that the complaint was filed. Now, in their own moving papers, they have a declaration of someone who reviewed a business record and testified that in 2018, the note was in the possession of plaintiff's then counsel. However, that very business record that they referenced said something completely different. It said it was in the possession of Aquin. And there was no evidence in the record whatsoever that at that time the note contained the endorsement. It's not enough that the plaintiff holds the note on the day that the complaint's filed. It's got to be endorsed to the plaintiff as well. And there was no evidence of that on this record. I would submit that
this was a bearer note. I thought there was a blank note.
Well, it wouldn't matter. That endorsement, whether it's a special endorsement or a blank endorsement, it had to exist. It had to be on the note and it had to be in the possession of the plaintiff on the day that the complaint was filed, whether it was blank or a special endorsement to this plaintiff. All of these are meritorious issues worthy of adjudication on the merits. The ICA didn't even reach that issue. The ICA hung its hat on a finding that Ms. Rue had engaged in inexcusable neglect or a willful act by her own failure to file her file an answer. You know, the default, obviously, it's the result of not filing an answer, but the question of good cause, even under the factors, it's a question of why she didn't file it. Well, again, COVID, also factor in, she did hire an attorney relatively expeditiously, and the very first thing that was done was an agreement to set aside the default. All of that shows good cause. It shows an intention to appear and defend. Those are the kind of facts that a court would set aside a clerk's entry of default, you know, under the good cause standard. That shouldn't be a bar to later Rule 60B relief, especially under these sorts of facts. Now, this idea of an evidentiary hearing, again, the plaintiff proposed it in our reply. We didn't object. We did say we don't believe it's necessary on this record. The reason for that is this record is clear. Ms. Rue's counsel repeatedly failed to show for hearings, didn't file anything. So even if we ignore all of the testimony in the client's declaration, all of the, you know, hearsay statements on both sides, the record itself, just the procedural history in this case, shows abandonment. And well, those factors alone should be enough under Rule 60B6 to set this aside and allow this case to proceed on the merits.
In Uehara, this court addressed whether counsel's conduct was egregious enough to satisfy 60B6. And in that case, the attorney settled a claim without client consent. And so that seemed pretty egregious, but because the client later ratified that settlement, and that's what this court determined, there was no 60B6 relief. So I guess, you know, there's some symmetry in the sense of, I take your point about Mr. Sanaha's alleged, and it is alleged, conduct or lack of action here. And yet the question about your client's actions in seeking the loan modification and having the opportunity to go that route and avoid the lawsuit. Isn't that a similar circumstance here?
Well, I think in Uehara, you know, that case didn't involve claims of abandonment. And I think this record shows abandonment. If there's an argument to be made that, well, the client had some heightened duty to track the case, even though she'd hired counsel based on receiving a loan mod offer and receiving a denial, then I think there's an important fact that doesn't appear on this record that's got to be tested. Did she receive that offer? Did she know that she was allowed to make payments under this proposed offer, and did she then later receive the rejection? But then, so, even if she did, would it be reasonable for her then to be expected to go in and figure out how to research the case when she's hired counsel to do it?
Okay, so you don't contest Exhibits 3 and 4 that we've referenced?
No.
You contest whether she received it? Is that the
whether
point?
She received it, her understanding of it, if she did receive it.
You didn't have an opportunity to file a reply memorandum to their memorandum in opposition to your motion to set aside the default judgment?
We did file a reply
memorandum. And did you file a declaration saying, my client never received? No. Did your client file a declaration saying, I never saw these loan modification letters?
No, we didn't. Those facts are not on the record.
I'm sorry. They filed a declaration saying, here's the loan modification letters that we sent to your client. You had you filed a reply, and your client's reply did not say, we didn't receive these loan modification letters.
No. We focused elsewhere in the reply that strategically didn't seem necessary at the time. It would have probably been the better thing to do. But again, evidence in a reply is, you know, shaky.
When they said, hey, we arranged with the loan modification with her attorney, and that she didn't make any payments, and that's why we went ahead with the foreclosure. Well, you didn't think it was necessary to respond to that?
I guess the bigger question is, even if she did receive it, and even if she understood that the foreclosure would be resumed, wouldn't she then be reasonable to rely on her attorney to defend the foreclosure? From what we can tell, she didn't know that a motion for default judgment had ever been filed, let alone, you know, orally granted by the judge. She didn't know that if she didn't make payments under a loan mod or if a loan mod was rejected, that an order was going to be entered. Those are questions. But I think based on this record, just the track record of counsel's failure to appear at multiple hearings, failure to defend, failure to do the one thing he said he'd do at the outset, stipulate to set aside dismissal, you know, I think those facts are enough to grant 60B relief.
You're about out of time. You want to wrap up?
With that said, again, I do believe there's enough on this record that demonstrates abandonment by counsel. I do believe that Rule 60B6 should have been employed by the ICA. I think that their decision should be vacated. This case should be remanded either for an evidentiary hearing or this court can very well reverse the circuit court's orders based on this record. Thank you.
Thank you for the party's arguments. This matter will be taken under advisement. Thank you.
Ku iluna, please rise. Ua ho o ku u ia mai ne kea aha ho o kolo kolo ki e ke hanahano o ka moku aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.